What's up, guys? Here on the podcast, we're going to recap a big, big Week 10. Then we got a special guest coming in to break down Lamar Jackson and everything that the Ravens are doing on offense. And as always, we'll get to all of your questions in the mailbag. Let's go. Welcome in. It's the MMQB podcast with Albert Breer. Week 10's in the books, and what a Week 10 it was. We had fantastic finishes all over the NFL, not the least of which was the last game played in Week 10, the game between the Niners and the Seahawks, which we'll get to in a minute. We had the fantastic, fantastic finish in Nashville between the Titans and the Chiefs and Patrick Mahomes' return. The Bucks-Cardinals game, not great teams, but a great finish in that one. The Cowboys and the Vikings, the Steelers and the Rams. Just a great Sunday and Monday of football. And so we'll jump right into it with our five takeaways before we get to a very special guest today. And my number one takeaway, that Seattle-San Francisco game, as good as it gets for regular season football, and it was about the defensive lineman. You want to know why we could have a defensive lineman go first overall next year with Chase Young coming out of Ohio State. You want to know why we've had defensive linemen go first overall over quarterbacks in the past, guys like Mario Williams and Jadeveon Clowney. That right there is why. There were game wreckers all over the field. Clowney has his breakout performance for Seattle. On the other side, you've got Nick Bosa, you've got DeForest Buckner, guys making game-changing plays. All over the place, we saw great, great defensive linemen and the difference those guys can make. And it's going to be interesting to see if these two teams keep up this pace and we do see them in January and maybe we see them playing for a berth in the Super Bowl, just like old times, just like we saw 5-6 years ago out of the NFC West. Like, it's going to be interesting to see the effect this has on the NFL and the effect this has on the value of a guy coming out like Chase Young, who, again, I think is going to be right there with Tua Tagovailoa and Justin Herbert and perhaps Joe Burrow in the running for the first overall pick. But my biggest takeaway from the game was just the difference that my MVP through 10 weeks, Russell Wilson, makes for you on a night when maybe he wasn't perfect. All right, he had a critical interception in overtime. There were ups and downs. They weren't all that consistent. They couldn't get out of their own way in the first half. But one of the great things that you saw from Russell Wilson, how does a quarterback react when things aren't great, when the situation around him isn't ideal? We saw it in Week 9. And again, this is one of the reasons why he's my MVP at this point. We saw it in Week 9 where he's throwing to guys and DK Metcalf and Jacob Hollister who weren't even on the team in 2018. And we saw it again late in the game against the San Francisco 49ers on Monday night. We saw it in a 3rd and 16. And you guys remember the play. He's rolling out to his right, I believe, on the play. Finds Malik Turner. Again, a player who, quite honestly, I hadn't heard much about. Was an undrafted free agent coming out in 2018, signed with the team in July of 2018. And he's making a big play on 3rd and 16 to extend a drive. Now that winds up leading to the interception. He comes back, escapes a zero blitz on 3rd and 3, winds up breaking loose, big run, 16 yards. That winds up setting up the game-winning field goal. So again, the ability for Russell Wilson to roll with the punches the way he did in what's a huge game, what could be a game that has huge implications on the playoff race. It could determine who gets a bye. It could determine where a playoff game is played in January. Just a fantastic, fantastic MVP-like, I'm not going to say performance, MVP-like resiliency from Russell Wilson in a game that, again, I think the main takeaway from a football standpoint is the value of defensive linemen. Takeaway number two, if Jason Garrett isn't in Dallas next year, I think the play calling down the stretch against Minnesota is going to be one thing that we point to as a reason why. Now, remember, the Cowboys don't need to fire Jason Garrett. His contract is up. They'll have a decision to make. It's either you give him a brand new contract or you move on from him. And you could have options like Oklahoma's Lincoln Riley on the table. The Cowboys are the Cowboys. I mean, Urban Meyer could be on the table for them. There's a lure to that job. There's good talent on the roster. They'll be able to get some coaches some teams couldn't get. And so, big decision coming for the franchise. And again, these are the sorts of things that I think you pick apart from a coach. And even in a situation like this one where, you know, the play calling is Kellen Moore's, you have to look at this and you have to look at the end of this game. And Dak was dealing. Dak was playing so well. And you get in second and two and you run the ball twice with Ezekiel Elliott against a defense that's geared up to stop the run. And then you roll out on fourth down, cut off half the field, and throw what I, you know, normally would be a high percentage throw to Zeke, but gets broken up by one of the best coverage linebackers in the league in Eric Kendricks. And so the way the last three offensive snaps went for Dallas, I think if this winds up going the other way over the next 7 weeks, this is going to be something that we're going to point to. I think Garrett's done a decent job on balance over his 9 years there. But if this thing goes the wrong way, that sequence at the end of the Minnesota game is going to be something we're going to look at as a turning point in their season. Number three, and we're going to look at a couple of the bad teams now. How about that? Or maybe they're not so bad anymore. The Dolphins have won two straight. We heard Brian Flores say it after the game. We're out to win every game, period. And I really like what the Dolphins are doing. I think the job Brian Flores has done over his first 2 months as a head coach, I think is fantastic. That program is demanding. It's old school. To a lot of players, the stuff that they have you do in that program is foreign. It's not what you get at some of the big college programs. It's not what you get elsewhere in the NFL. It's different. It's tough. And so to be able to keep the team on board, continue to get the effort that he's gotten from different guys on that roster, from the whole roster, over the first 2 months of the season, despite not being able to provide the results that guys in New England get, I think has been outstanding. It's a challenging situation for the coach. I think Brian Flores has done a fantastic job, and it's good to see him and his players get some tangible results from that in winning the last 2 weeks and being able to turn what they had here into tangible results. That said, this could wind up costing them. Now, they've built up all this draft capital, and that's great. But the Jets in 2017 had a little bit of a burst at the beginning of their season, right? The beginning of the 2017 season, we thought the Jets might be going somewhere. Now, you remember the 2017 draft, they punted on going and getting a quarterback. They said, we're waiting until 2018. And they started their season 3-2. They won three straight. What did that three-game winning streak do? It knocked them down in the draft order to sixth. That wound up costing them 3 second-round picks because they had made the decision in 18 they were going to go and get their quarterback. So their second-round pick, their slotted second-round pick in 18, the second-round pick they got for Sheldon Richardson in a trade, and their 2019 second-round pick all went to Indianapolis so they could move up three spots and get Sam Darnold. All right, those players for the Colts. The Colts wound up with this haul from that trade. Quentin Nelson, Braden Smith, Kamiko Terre, Jordan Wilkins, and Rocky Sin. Five players. Five players that the Colts believe can be starting-level players if they aren't starting already. And one first-team All-Pro. That's what the Colts got out of that trade. So that's sort of an illustration of what the Dolphins are playing with here, where if they're going to draft their quarterback next year and they have to trade up to do it, they're actually costing themselves some of that draft capital. Regardless, great job by Brian Flores on the field over the first 2 months of the season. I don't think there's any question about that. You don't see some of the goofiness you see sometimes with first-year coaches from him and his staff. The team looks together. The effort's been consistent, and finally it's bearing out some results. Takeaway number four, the Bengals look terrible, and I can tell you guys this. The staff there has looked at the roster and there's been a determination there that this thing needs to be blown up, that this thing needs to start over. And that was a part of why they moved away from Andy Dalton. Okay? There are very few players in that roster that will be there when the rebuild is done. You got Geno Atkins and A.J. Green, guys in their 30s. You got Tyler Boyd. You have Joe Mixon. And really after that, the way the staff sees it, and obviously you get Jonah Williams back next year, the rest needs to be turned over. And so the Bengals now are squarely in a position of having to look at the 2020 quarterback class and put resources into doing that. And so it's going to be fascinating now seeing some of these teams that are positioning themselves to draft one in 2020. You got Tua Tagovailoa, who is a very natural, accurate passer. Looks in certain ways like he was born to play quarterback, classically trained, not overly big. He's got the durability concern. He's got good, not great arm strength and good, not great athleticism. You got Justin Herbert, who's got all the physical traits you could want, but is still a little raw, needs to work on his footwork, has been a little inconsistent. And then you got Joe Burrow, who's crashing the party, who's got maybe good, not great traits, but has intangibles through the roof, has proven to be a winner, and has consistently gotten better. So it's going to be exciting to watch the way those guys position themselves and how the Dolphins and Bengals and some of the other teams at the top wind up playing the rest of the season out with so much on the line in a very interesting way. And then finally, number five, takeaway number five. I could start every week with Lamar Jackson. Maybe it's a little boring if we do that. So we're not going to start every week with Lamar Jackson, but what we saw again, just off the charts. And I think what's amazing about Lamar Jackson is you look at the way that he plays in these games and you look at the numbers at the end, right? And so against the Patriots, I believe he had about, and I'd have to look this up, but I think he had about 160 yards passing and 60 yards on the ground. Against the Ravens, 223 yards passing, 65 yards on the ground. Those are good numbers, not great numbers. His passer rating, of course, was off the charts against the Bengals. Perfect passer rating. But the way he affects everything that the defense does, to me, is fascinating. I think what they're doing from a scheme standpoint is sustainable. To me, what this all comes down to is whether or not you're going to be able to keep him healthy in 2, 3, 4 years. Where is he from a health standpoint? So that, to me, is the most important thing to watch. And that's where we're going to go with our special guest. Right after this, we are going to bring in someone I respect immensely, who knows this stuff back and forth, to break down Lamar Jackson today and where Lamar Jackson will be in the future. All right, and this week's guest, I'm really excited to have him on because one of the biggest stories in the NFL over the course of the first 10 weeks of the season, without question, is Lamar Jackson. And there's so much there with how the Ravens have gotten here, what they've done to accommodate Lamar, and then how Lamar's performed in the environment that's there for him in Baltimore. And one of my favorite guys as far as just watching guys who break down tape and understand offense front and back is actually fairly new. I think I'd say you're fairly new to the media scene, Dan. That's former Lions, Colts, Bucks, Rams. Did I miss anybody there? Quarterback.
Texans.
From ESPN, Dan Orlovsky. Dan, I appreciate you coming out.
Good to be with you, bud.
All right, so here's where I want to start. Like, I think the biggest question has to be the sustainability of this. And, you know, we've seen these sorts of option-based offenses take the league by storm in the past. Obviously, what Colin Kaepernick did in 2011 and 2012 with the Niners. We saw it with Robert Griffin III with the Redskins and Kyle Shanahan in 2012. Greg Roman, of course, was there with the Niners in 11 and 12 when Cap just blew up the way he did. I'm wondering, just like from your standpoint, watching it right now, how different is it from what we saw back then?
It's not totally different than what we saw with Greg Roman and Cap. I mean, they are doing things that are very similar to what they did back then. There's probably two things that are the main difference. There's more just drop back pass in the Ravens offense than there was in the Niners offense. Lamar is executing the drop back pass, your traditional pocket passing, probably at a little bit higher level than Kaepernick did. And that's the difference between them, number one. Now, there are some differences, though, in the functionality of it. You know, Albert, I kind of say it's like indefensible right now. And The reason is because, I mean, they're the only team in the NFL that runs this scheme. And the difference between them and, let's say, San Francisco was the Ravens got three tight ends. All three of them can block in the run game, block in the pass game, and be really good receivers horizontally and vertically. San Francisco didn't have three guys who could do that, and that's a massive difference maker for the Ravens.
So explain how that works then. Why is that specific position having guys who can do both? And I'm assuming you're talking about you're talking about Andrews and Boyle and Hurst. Like, so like, why is that position specifically so important to what they're trying to do?
Okay, so first of all, everyone like knows about matchups and the matchup advantage that you can gain out of it. So, I mean, think about what teams have done with one tight end. That was a matchup problem, a Rob Gronkowski or a Travis Kelce or a Zach Ertz. Now you've added a second guy in. Think about the really good offenses who have had two tight ends that have been matchup problems because both of them were good pass blockers and run game guys. Like, I'm the Patriots come to mind. There's not a lot of teams that have gone with the two tight ends. The Eagles do it. They have three. So you put three tight ends on the field that can run game block. So you are essentially playing as an offense with eight offensive linemen in that regard, because you've got eight capable blockers in your run game. So naturally as a defense where you go, goodness, you know, they've got eight people on the field that are part of their run game, that are a good part of their run game. Well, we can't just play with four defensive linemen then, can we? Like, we have to put a fifth defensive lineman on the field or a sixth defensive lineman, or maybe we have to put bigger linebackers on the field. And so now, whatever you do defensively, I'm automatically at an advantage just off my personnel, in the run or the pass. And as the defenses try to adjust and go, okay, well, we're going to put five big guys on the field to stop the run or six big guys up on the field to stop the run. Well, now I'm at a different advantage because those big guys can't cover. They can't cover a Hayden Hurst or a Boyle or an Andrews running down the field. So because the Ravens have those three guys, before the ball ever gets snapped, they're at an advantage. Before it's ever getting snapped, they're at a personnel advantage. And there's nobody in the NFL defensively that is prepared for that. That has the personnel that is prepared to take them on over the course of a game.
And you haven't even mentioned Ingram and Jackson yet, right? Yeah, like, so you're just talking about the eight guys, and you haven't even brought up the quarterback or the running back yet.
Yeah, I mean, so it starts with scheme. Like, it starts with the, and I mentioned this, they got the only, they're the only crew in the league that's doing it with the scheme. The person, the tight ends matter. Like, every, and I love Lamar, and I think he's been galaxies better than 99% of the people thought he would be. But it's the tight ends that truly make it go. And then the quarterback. Then you have the only quarterback that is like that in the NFL. So, you know, I've talked about this the past couple of weeks. The NFL is about man hours and how many man talent, yes, but how many man hours that you can deploy to figuring out what the other team is going to do and then countering that. Think about the man hours it takes to prepare for the Ravens. And just all the – because you can't go back and go, oh, you know what, we're playing the 49ers. They do the same stuff as the Rams. You know, that's not – we're playing the Ravens. They don't do – they do the same stuff as Oklahoma. Like, so it's good luck trying to prepare for them. And then this past weekend when they put the Heisman package on the field was not by accident. And so you're adding more time and things that they need to prepare for.
So is it like if you're a coach now, you're worried that Griffin's going to throw out of that, right?
Exactly. I mean, they don't think for a second that Greg Roman didn't save that package for the Bengals game in a game that he knew that they would be in control of and that they would win and be in, you know, no fear or jeopardy of losing that football game. And then they just roll it out there because there's other things coming now. And now as a defense, you go, OK, we got to prepare for that. But what else are they going to do off of it is also something that you now have to hope you get right for in the future.
Okay, so I remember like watching, like, so in the Super Bowl, right? Like what the Patriots did at the end of the game. They went 22 personnel, and I remember talking to their coaches about this, and the adjustment they made was putting Rex Burkhead in that package, right, instead of Sony Michel, because he could catch the ball. And so they basically said, well, we think that all of these different defenses are built with 250-pound defensive linemen, 220-pound linebackers. They're all built to deal with the spread passing game. And so yep. what are we going to do? We're going to put big people on the field, and we're going to run it right down their throats, and we're going to be able to throw out of these sets too, because then they're going to put people who they haven't generally put on the field to deal with it. It's the same thing, right? Like, it's different because Brady's exactly. the quarterback, but is what the Ravens are doing, like, I would think it's sort of like a cousin of what Belichick did in the playoffs, right?
You're exactly right, man. You hit the nail on the head that and everyone else is zigging, they're zagging. You know, that's the reality of what they're doing. They're taking something that no one else does. You don't practice against it. You haven't practiced against it in training camp. You don't see it on tape every week. And they're just going, we're going to be the only people to do this. Now, let me be clear. This is not like NFL. People know that the NFL is a copycat league. They don't have the copycat offense, though. Like, again, it matters that Greg Roman's the guy doing it. You can't just say, oh, hey, coach, watch this and then call it for our offense. It matters that they have the three tight ends. If they had two, it wouldn't be as dangerous. And then it matters that it's Lamar Jackson. Absolutely.
Right. So, like, it's the same as, I mean, and you put, like, the fullback on the field, like the way the Niners use the fullback, the way the Patriots yep. use the fullback, it's the same sort of thing, right?
Yeah, how are you going to differentiate yourself? Like, what are you going to do that is going to make you hard to stop? Like, what are you going to do that's different that's going to make you hard to stop? Now, some teams do it strictly off people, right? Like,
yeah.
They'll do it. We're just more talented than you. And then the good organizations figure out, all right, well, everyone, okay, where can we be different than everyone else? And that's why I say it's indefensible in a way, because you only get so much time to get ready for it. And then you got to go execute against it. That's a wholly different challenge.
Right. So it's like, is the Army, Navy, Air Force, is that like a fair way to look at it? Like, you know, and I even think like back to, I mean, crap, I played high school football at a low level, but I remember like how much of a pain in the ass it was when you played an option offense. And like, and yeah. you always hear Army and Navy and Air Force, like when, you know, big time colleges go up against them. We saw the way Michigan struggled with Army. Like, and that's all yep. about like, well, you just haven't seen that. And I, you know, like your eyes aren't trained to look at it a certain way. And so when you get out there against it, it's really hard to deal with because a lot of the rules are different. And I even had a defensive coach say to me, it's like, with the defensive players, their eyes are taught to see things one way, and now they're doing tricks on them. So is that the fair yeah. comparison to make? Like Army, Navy, like what you'd see in college is sort of existing in the NFL now?
Yeah, I mean, I would say it's more Oklahoma, you know, because okay. of the threat of the vertical pass game. But the concept of it is very much Army, Navy, yes, where, okay, this is our 1 week where we got to play this team, and we have no idea what we're doing against them, and so good luck in trying to figure it out. And then, yes, the eyes, okay, who's got the football? Where is the football? Where's the football going? And all of a sudden the ball is outside and it's gone for 15, 20 yards. So the concept, yeah, is the eye challenge for defenses in the Army-Navy aspect. But the actual application of it is Oklahoma and what they're doing offensively. The vertical stretch with the horizontal stretch on the same play. And then the ability to go physical run game, but also spread you out in the pass game at the same time. Like, that's the challenge mm-hmm. for it.
Is it? So is it sustainable? I mean, is it like, because you hear a lot of people say, and I don't subscribe to this, but you hear a lot of people say, well, that's trickery. It's gimmicky. And we saw like the way it died out in San Francisco and the way it died out in Washington. And like, do you think that, just schematically, let's take we'll talk about the injury thing in a second, but like schematically, is what they're doing sound enough to sustain?
Schematically, absolutely. I mean, because they're going to continue to stay ahead of everybody with the times. Like, schematically, yes. Because, like, people need to understand it's, well, if I go into my pass game, right, and I go three level pass game, right, I have a deep pylon route, a deep crossing route and a flat route. That's really the triple option. It's just in the pass game. I got three options and I'm putting another guy in a bind. Well, they're just doing different ways. Like, it's all about gaining a numbers advantage. And that's what sports are. And that's what football is. And so they're gaining the numbers advantage all the time because of their personnel, because of their scheme and the option style. So schematically, is it sustainable? Yes. Do I think it'll happen? Listen, I would love to sit here and try to be the smart person. I don't know because you can point to it and say, well, it fizzed out in San Francisco. Yeah, but that was because Kaepernick was willing to take shots. So, like, Kaepernick would get up from hits and flex on people. Lamar doesn't really take a lot of hits. Like, Lamar avoids the hits. He's so quick and subtle that he gets down. And the same, like, RG3 was, I think as RG3 is a little bit unfortunate as well. The knee. And then also, he was straight line. The RG3 wasn't the shiftiness. The shiftiness is what avoids taking the hits for Lamar.
So you just don't think he's taking – you think he's good. And I think, like, Russell was sort of this way early in his career too, right? Like, where he does a good enough job and has the instincts and, like, the spatial awareness to avoid hits enough where this could be sustainable.
Look at the Cincinnati play, the 47-yard touchdown run on Sunday. The spin move, right? I mean, he's in the air. Three guys are there, and it's the spin move. What did everyone say about Russell Wilson when he came out? Like, oh, blah, 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 blah. Or not when he came out, but when he started to have success. Well, is he going to stay healthy? What did everyone say about Kyler Murray coming into this year? Like, oh, man, he's one big hit away. Well, you guys tell me when that big hit's coming, because he's played 10 games, and I don't think he's been touched. Like, these guys, I can't do it. Not many people can, but they just have this subtlety of knowing when to get down, when not to get down, where to get down. Like, It is a gift. It's a skill. It's a talent that they can see everything at the same. It's almost like a spidey sense in a way, where they avoid consistent big hits. Yeah.
Okay. So does this change the way? And I know, you know, in April you'll be looking at all the quarterbacks like everybody else. Do you think this changes the way that you personally will look at quarterbacks and evaluate quarterbacks? And do you think it'll change the way teams evaluate quarterbacks? I always think back to, and you're about the same age as me, I think back to my childhood and guys like Tommy Frazier and Scott, like the guys that we watched play that style of offense, play, you know, in option offenses that were spectacular. And you almost wonder, thinking back, like, I wonder if that guy would have worked or that guy would have worked now. Do you think that this is going to change the way, and maybe it already has, that you'll look at a quarterback coming into the NFL, and do you think ultimately it's going to change the way teams look at the quarterback coming into the NFL over the next few years?
Well, I think we've already started that change. I honestly do. I think we've already started to see this transition. But so part of me says, yeah, and then part of me says no. Because Lamar's rare. Like, there's not a lot of Lamar Jacksons going on. Like, Lamar Jackson went to Louisville, and Louisville got outstanding. You know, when Lamar was coming out, I'll be honest with you, I said, because everyone was saying he can't throw, and I was like, I don't see that. Like, I think a guy can throw plenty. I said, why can't you use him like the Broncos used Jake Plummer? Like, I didn't see him as a wide receiver. I was like, this kid's if you use him the right way, he could be a really good player. But you got to let him be the right way, and it stresses your franchise now, because it affects every move that your franchise makes.
Because you have to be all in.
Yeah, you got to be all in. And that's why the Ravens, you got to credit the Ravens, because they have been all in, where so many organizations don't. So, you know, I think we've already started to look at them a little bit differently. I don't think it's going to make me look at them differently, because here's the reason, the difference. And I'll use present day as an example. Jalen Hurts at Oklahoma has been unbelievable this year, and their offense is rolling. He has totally showed to be a much better player than what the perception was him at Alabama. But Jalen Hurts isn't going to be a first-round pick. And Jalen Hurts isn't going to be a second-round pick. Jalen Hurts will end up being a fourth-round pick or something like that, because he's still not nearly the electric thrower and the thrower that Lamar is and was. You know, like, it still comes down to, can you throw? Lamar was always able to throw. The difference between Lamar this year and last year is he's hitting the easy throws. Last year he didn't hit the easy throws. This year he's hitting them. That's the big difference. And because people don't watch tape, they don't pay attention. And so I don't think it's going to be this influx of these guys that are, oh, my goodness, we've never seen players like this before. One, because it's rare. And two, because it's really hard to find everybody doing it the right way.
Right, but like Jalen Hurts might have an opportunity if more teams are doing this, right? Because somebody's going to draft him as a backup now, right? Like, I mean, I would think he'd be attractive to the Ravens now, because you look at him and you say, all right, like, well, we need depth at that position if something happens to Lamar, and here's a guy who can come in and run that offense, right?
Yeah, I mean, there's probably going to be more opportunities, but I don't think there's going to be more opportunities where, okay, that guy's the franchise. Go get him as a top 10 pick. You know, I don't think we're going to see that because of the rarity of a guy like Lamar. but you might see more opportunities for guys, yes.
Okay, I got two last questions for you. Number one, you were in the league at the same time as Michael Vick. I wonder what someone like Michael Vick would look like in an offense like this. Do you think, what do you think that would have looked like?
I mean, probably similar to like when Michael Vick had his stretch where it was like, yeah, okay. Like, but we're playing who? Atlanta? Cool. We get to have fun watching. It would probably be like the highlights that we see of Michael, but on a consistent basis. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
Like, it wouldn't be the one or two or three play highlights from a game. Like, that would just be the game. There would be highlight after highlight after highlight. And so he would have tremendous. I mean, he was tremendous. He would have tremendous success in the league right now.
Okay. And this is a question I'm really interested to hear you answer, just because I think it's kind of the operative question. And it goes back to like what we saw with San Francisco, what we saw with Washington. Where's Lamar Jackson in 5 years? What is he in 5 years?
Okay. And we're assuming complete health here, right?
Right.
Ideal situation.
Let's assume. Okay. Let's assume that he finds a way to stay healthy despite. And again, I think it's like 10 to 15 carries a game right now. Let's assume that he can stay healthy. What is he in 5 years?
He is Michael Vick. He's a guy that is transcending a position and inspiring young kids to do it differently and inspiring young kids to and take me the like to not look the prototypical way or the historical way and it be okay. And I think we've already started that transition and that trend. But it'll become cool. It'll become wanted. It'll become it'll be like, oh, we've got to try to find the kid that reminds everybody of Lamar Jackson.
Is it fun for you to watch Baltimore tape every week? Like, is that like, and I know you try to watch everybody, but is that like the one that you want to kind of get your hands on first?
Yeah, I mean, I love watching everybody, yes, but I love watching coaches. I've always felt this way. I hate when coaches ask guys to do things they can't do and ask people to do stuff that they're incapable of. And I love coaches that identify this guy's really good at this stuff and we're going to do a ton of it. And then how are we going to do it? So I love watching the first three plays of the Baltimore game against Cincinnati this week are all from the same formation, same pre-snap motion and shift, same play action, but they're three different plays.
Yeah.
And they go down to the 1 yard line. Like, I just love watching a coach have such a good understanding of that.
You know what's funny about that? Like, that reminds me of like, now I feel like I'm going back to my high school game, but like, that reminds me of like the wing tee, like what the wing tee was in high school, you know?
Deception and create, you know, confusion and multiple people going different ways. Absolutely.
All right. He's Dan Orlovsky. You can catch his work on ESPN. You're on Get Up a few times a week, right?
I'm going to do that.
All right. I always appreciate talking to you, Dan. Appreciate you coming out. We'll definitely have you on again soon.
Thanks, bud.
All right. Thanks again to Dan for that. Check him out on ESPN. I didn't mention it there, but you should also check him out and follow him on Twitter at DanOrlovsky7. Does a fantastic job breaking all of this stuff down in a very, I think, relatable way. Like, for people who aren't working for NFL teams, like, everybody can understand the way that Dan explains it. Very simple. He takes the complicated and makes it easy to understand for all of us. Now we'll jump into the mailbag. You guys know how this works. Every week I put the call out for questions. We're giving you guys now two ways to get to us. You can get us through email at BreerMailbag@gmail.com. That's my last name, mailbag@gmail.com. That's BreerMailbag@gmail.com. And we sort of prefer you do it this way just because we want to hear your voice. I know it's cool for you guys to hear your voice on the podcast. You can call us at 201-596-4346. That's 201-596-4346. And just so you know, you don't need to wait until Monday or Tuesday to do it. You guys can leave messages there whenever you want. Now I'll bring in my producer, Shelby. Question number one.
From David. Are the Colts a legitimate contender when healthy, or the past two losses, Steelers and Dolphins, more telling about this team than the previous two wins, Kansas City and Houston?
I don't think that they're... I think that this is purely about the quarterback, and Brian Hoyer can kind of drive the bus, but he can't lift you up the way that I think Jacoby Brissett is capable of doing And it's crazy to say that now, because I don't think anybody would have said that 2 months ago. But Jacoby Brissett is capable of kind of lifting the level of the players around him. And so I think when Brissett's healthy, and the expectation is he'll play this coming week against the Jaguars, I think we will see the Colts team that we saw prior to the loss to the Steelers. And you got to remember, too, if Adam Vinatieri hits the field goal at the end of the Steeler game, and if he hits an extra point in the Dolphin game, you know, they've won the Steeler game, and they're probably going to overtime with the Dolphins, and they're in a much different situation right now. And so I still think that's a really good roster. I think the roster continue to get better. There's still some things that Chris Ballard needs to work on. They could still use a number one corner. They could still use like a war daddy type of pass rusher. And they still could use a number one receiver, like a bona fide big outside number one receiver. But outside of that, I think they've got a lot of pieces in place. And, I mean, again, this is going to be a team that I think is going to be good for a while. Shelby, question number two.
From Naheem, I think the Eagles made a mistake in signing Jordan Matthews. And should they have signed J.J. Nelson instead because he resembles DeSean Jackson more?
I know what you're saying. I also and I understand like the desire to have like the speed element there. I think Nelson Aguilar brings that for you to some degree, and I think at this point of the season, it's important to like look at it and say to yourself, okay, where can we get a guy in December? Where can we get a guy in January? How can he contribute for us for the next 8 weeks of the regular season, 7 weeks of the regular season, and then into the playoffs? And I just think because of the timing of it, Jordan Matthews made sense because there isn't a learning curve there, because he can come in and he can play for you right away. Now, is the receiver position going to be a position of strength for them? Probably not. I mean, Alshon Jeffery, I don't think, quite lived up to expectations when you signed him to the big deal. Aguilar's good, not great. You know, Matt Collins, I think, has given you a little something. You're still waiting on the rookie J.J. Arcega-Whiteside. So I think you've got decent balance at the position, but I don't think it's going to be a huge strength at any point this year. Which means you're probably leaning on your tight ends a little bit more, Zach Ertz and Dallas Goedert, and what they can bring to the table. Shelby, question number three.
From Martin in Scotland. Would McCaffrey's potential last-second touchdown not have ruled out if it had been ruled he crossed the goal line? The offensive lineman pulled him from behind, which was against the rules, but no one seems to have mentioned it.
It's funny that it's Martin's his name, right?
Yeah.
Okay, Martin. It's funny you mentioned that because I always think that now. And my point of reference is actually like USC Notre Dame, I think it was 2006. And you guys remember that, the Bush push game where I can't remember if it was Leinart or if it was one of his linemen, but they pushed Reggie Bush into the end zone. And I remember hearing after the game about how that was against the rules. And you sort of like after that, like I sort of had my radar up for these things happening, and you always see it happen and it never gets called. So you're absolutely right about that. I think McCaffrey probably did get in. Like if you ask me, like was there a point where that ball crossed the goal line based on where his body was and everything else? I think he probably did get in. You just didn't get a good look at it. And so my feeling on that one is, and there's plenty of stuff to pick apart when it comes to the officiating from week 10. My feeling on that one is whichever way that was called on the field was going to stand. And since that was called as McCaffrey being down at the 1-inch line, the 6-inch line, the 1-foot line, whatever it was, and because it was called that way, it was going to stand because we just didn't have a good enough look at where the ball was. I also think the interesting thing here is there probably is a way for technology to solve this one too. If you put a chip on the ball and have some sort of laser from pylon to pylon, I've heard coaches bring that up in the past, and this would be one of those situations where it might make sense to look into some technology like that. Again, if your priority is getting the thing right. Shelby, question number four.
Got a voicemail from Travis.
Hey, Albert. It's Travis from Calgary. I had a question about John Lynch. Now that what he and Kyle Shanahan have done has proven that he isn't a good GM, probably a great GM, is it possible more guys from the media are going to get GM jobs, or is it unique because Kyle hired John? Thank you. Love the pod. Have a good one.
Well, thanks for the question, Travis. I would say this. I remember a conversation I had with Mike Vrabel about how he'd sort of risen through the ranks quickly, right? And he was an assistant coach at Ohio State for 3 years and then a head coach or an assistant coach at at Houston with the Texans for another 4 years. So he had 7 years as an assistant. That's a faster track than most people who become NFL head coaches are on. I remember asking him about that, and his response was, well, my 15 years as a player don't count. I think we're going to see the same thing with some guys on the coaching side over the next couple of years. Guys like Kevin O'Connell in Washington, Gerard Mayo in New England, Byron Leftwich in Tampa, Kellen Moore in Dallas. There are a lot of guys who had a lot of experience as players and are rising through the ranks quickly now based on having that experience, having played the game, which makes sense to me because you do have something, you have a perspective that people who didn't play lack. And so that makes some sense to me. I do think Lynch is a little bit of an outlier based on the fact that he had sort of done some legwork in the background to get ready for this. John Elway actually helped him and invited him in for stuff. He was able to be a fly on the wall in certain situations. So he had sort of gotten himself ready to go in that way. So I don't think you're going to see a massive movement towards this happening because we have seen situations where it hasn't worked. Matt Millen in Detroit would be a great example of one where it didn't work. But like I do think in spots it does give you some confidence that it can work. Like Peyton Manning would be a good example of a guy who I think eventually will make that move and run a team. And so if you're the team that's hiring Peyton Manning to be your vice president of football operations, whatever it is, you probably feel a little bit better about it based on how like the job that John Lynch has done. And the main thing here is Lynch has built a healthy building, and Lynch has built a building that works in unison. And the scouts are picking players for the coaches. The coaches are communicating with the scouts. There's a synergy in the building. And I know that's what Jed York was really going for, was find a guy who can be a leader, find a guy who can sort of set the tone. And beyond just being an evaluator, that's what John Lynch has been able to do. He's been able to sort of figure out the rest on the fly. And again, it's about having good people around you. Adam Peters, the VP of player personnel, deserves credit. He came over from Denver. Somebody who worked in the Broncos scouting department, who John Lynch identified there. Kyle Shanahan on the coaching side. It's a really good place right now, the way they've got it set up. Different people pulling different levers, but everybody pointing in the same direction. Shelby, question number 5.
We have another voicemail.
What's up, Bert? Go Duxbury. Quick question to you regarding the Pats. Just wondering, with the addition of Mohamed Sanu, what you envision maybe Josh McDaniels' play calling changing. Obviously, he has passing capability along with Julian Edelman. Wondering if you'll see more creativity in the offensive scheme going forward. Also, what's going on with the running back we took in the third round from Alabama? Can't remember his name. Why isn't he seeing the field? Is it the ability to pick up? Just wondering what you've heard on that. Bye.
All right, 2 questions there. First question, I appreciate Go Duxbury. I didn't catch your name there, but Go Duxbury. On your first question, I think it's going to be similar to what you saw with Julian Edelman and Danny Amendola, in that you have 2 slots and you have some creativity. You have some flexibility to move those guys around and get creative with them. And both those guys should be a factor on third down, which makes you harder to defend. So if you want an idea of what it'll look like, go back to what it looked like when they were using Edelman and Amendola on the field at the same time. Sanu's a little bit of a different player. He's more of an Anquan Boldin type of slot, where they've had the shiftier slots, guys like Troy Brown, Wes Welker, obviously Julian and Danny fit into that as well. So this is a different type of slot. But in effect, the way it's going to kind of play out on the field is the same. As for Damian Harris, I would just say this. I think he's maybe the most talented back on the Patriots roster, which is why I thought he'd have a bigger role. I was wrong about that. Normally, when guys struggle to get on the field in New England at that position, it's because of pass protection. It's because of their ability to operate in Josh McDaniels' passing game. It's like, how is he as a blocker? How is he coming along as far as his knowledge of the passing game? They have a first and second down back in Sony Michel. They've got their passing game back in James White, and they've got sort of their hybrid in Rex Burkhead. I think Damian Harris has a chance to be a really good player, but clearly if he's going to be that guy, the passing game is where he's going to, I think – he's a first and second down back who has ability in the passing game. And so if he's going to pass Sony Michel on the depth chart or at least take carries from him, he's going to have to make his impact there because I think that's what would separate him from Michel. All right, Shelby, question number six.
Hey, Albert, Sam in Atlanta. I know your podcast is an NFL podcast. I couldn't help but think to myself when I'm watching LSU-Alabama on Saturday night, that was an NFL game. A lot of high-quality skill position players, all the speed on the field. Just loved it. Just felt like it was an NFL treat on a Saturday night. So just wondered what you thought about it. Thanks.
Yeah, Sam, absolutely. As everybody who's followed me knows, I'm a huge college football guy. There are certain programs, I think there are probably five of them right now, where if you put them on the field against one another, it does look like an NFL game. And I think the five programs right now would be LSU, Alabama, Ohio State, Clemson, and Georgia. Those five teams have NFL caliber talent at most positions. And I mean, I could go right on down the list. And it's not just the quarterbacks. Tua and Joe Burrow both have a shot to go in the first round in April. But beyond just that, it's the receiver talent. You mentioned it. Jordan Jefferson, Ja'Marr Chase for LSU. You got Jerry Jeudy, Devontae Smith, Henry Ruggs on Alabama. You got offensive and defensive linemen. You've got linebackers, you know, like Dylan Moses. You've got defensive backs like Trayvon Diggs and Grant Delpit. There's talent all over the field when those two teams meet. And again, there's about a handful of those teams in the college game where when you see one versus the other, it does take on the look of an NFL game. And I would say if right now I would tell you six or seven of those guys that were on that field in what felt like the de facto SEC championship game on Saturday night, like I would say six or seven of the guys on the field on Saturday night will wind up going in the first round of the 2020 NFL draft. Shelby, question number seven.
Last one from Matthew. Rams and Cowboys, two teams with high expectations going into the season, but thus far very underwhelming results. What do you attribute to these teams underperforming so far?
What's his name again?
That's from Matthew.
Matthew. Okay, Matthew, I think they're very different situations. With the Cowboys, I would say that the inability to get a consistent performance is the issue. Like, the defense has shown up big in spots. The offense has played really well in spots, but they haven't consistently brought it all together. I know that sounds like a kind of a cop-out answer. I do think there's talent on that roster. I think that, like, you look front to back, and to me, there's like find the holes, you know, like the offensive line isn't what it was 2 years ago, but it's still really, really good. You got Zeke Elliott and Amari Cooper, the skill position players. They've got better receivers complementing Cooper than they've had, guys like Randall Cobb and Michael Gallup. On the defensive side of the ball, you got playmakers all over the place. I mean, you know, to me, like, you got DeMarcus Lawrence and Leighton Vander Esch and Jalen Smith and like a corner group that with Byron Jones and Shadobia Awuzie and Jordan Lewis that maybe not great, but like is, you know, he got good players there. And so to me, it's just about having a consistent performance across the board, which, you know, again, you know, like we said earlier in the pod, if they're not getting it, then a lot of that, that's going to fall on the coaches at the end of the year. As for the Rams, I do think that there are positions roster-wise that aren't what they were. Running back's an obvious one, but the offensive line is another. And losing Roger Saffold, you know, you lose John Sullivan. Those guys were bedrocks for them over the last couple of years. You're bringing in young guys. You lose one of the guys in Joe Noteboom who you had at one of those positions. You know, to me, so much of what they were able to do the last couple of years was, all right, like, we signed Andrew Whitworth, we signed John Sullivan, now the offensive line's fixed. Well, that was a problem before Sean McVay got there, and now it feels like it's sort of a problem again, and we're seeing that crop up. Defensively, I think they've been fine. Defensively, I think they're good, you know? And so much of this to me sort of comes down to losing guys and not being as good on the offensive line, then not being as good at running back. It sort of ripped the identity from the offense, and they're going to have to figure out a new way to do it over the next 7 weeks, or else they're going to be at home when the playoffs begin in January. Appreciate you guys coming out. Again, if you want to get to us through the mailbag, we're always here for you. And we got two ways for you guys to get to us. Again, through email. That's breermailbag@gmail.com. Or you can leave a voicemail for me at 201-596-4346. Always want to hear your feedback. Always want to hear your voice, too. If you guys call us like Matthew and Sam and some of those guys did, you're going to hear your voice in the podcast, which is pretty cool. I love doing it that way. Makes me feel like I'm talking to you a little bit. And if you want your and if you guys got feedback on how we can do this whole thing better, like adjustments we can make and everything else, we're not adverse to the idea of some midseason adjustments. Just get me your feedback on Twitter at Albert Breer, on Facebook at Albert R. Breer, and on Instagram at Albert_Breer. And always remember to listen to all the MMQB podcasts, not just this one, the Monday Morning Podcast, which recaps everything on Sundays, the Weekside Podcast with Jenny and Connor, the Deep Dive Podcast, the Gambling Podcast, all of that's on one feed. That's the MMQB NFL Podcast. And, of course, you can also get the news, and you guys should know about this by now, but there's a separate feed now, the MMQB News Feed. That's where you get bite-sized news for your commute home, posts every afternoon, everything you need to know NFL-wise that you might have missed if you were at work and you were actually working and not screwing around on the internet. All of it's there for you, so you can just pop it in when you get in the car and catch up on everything that's happened in the NFL in 5 minutes or less. Same time next week. We'll see you guys then.